This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley.
Is it unpredictable that when someone needs help, they call 911? Kyle knew he was in trouble and didn't call his mom and dad. He knew he needed to call the one entity that could respond quickly and ultimately address the immediate crisis the best. Was that unpredictable?
I'm heartbroken, and talking to the officers and the dispatchers, they're heartbroken as well that they didn't get the help to this young man. But we can sit here and we can, you know, Monday morning quarterback this thing, but the reality is, you know, there were some failures and some breakdowns, and we have to do better.
You just heard a small part of the testimony of Ron Plush, the father of Kyle Plush, who died while trapped in his car on April the 10th. The comment was made during a hearing at Cincinnati City Council on Monday. The second voice was the comment of the testimony from Cincinnati Police Chief Elliot Isaacs at the same hearing. The difference in the sense of urgency felt by Ron Plush and the seeming lack of urgency conveyed by the chief spoke volumes beyond the written report that was presented. So where does the city go from here? To explore that question, we are joined by two reporters who have been covering this story from the beginning, WVXU's Jay Hanselman and WLWT television reporter Todd Dykes. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Jay, Todd, good to have you here this afternoon.
Happy to be here.
Okay.
Hey, good afternoon, Dan, and nice to hear from you too, Jay.
Very good. Beyond saying that there's room to improve, the police report and Chief Isaacs, did they lay out any sort of action plan that could really guide some sort of reform? Jay, you want to start here?
Prior to the release of the report on Monday, the acting city manager, Patrick Duhaney, had already laid out an action plan for the 911 Emergency Communications Center. I don't think there's been any action plan on what the police department could do differently. Todd, maybe I missed it, but I didn't hear it.
No, and I think what I'll find very intriguing, gosh, we're about a week and a half away from another meeting where law and public safety will try to have answers to these questions that Ron Plush laid out. You know, and Jay, you were there. I was there in a very matter-of-fact, calm voice. He just had these questions that I think any layperson would have, and obviously it's such an incredible tragedy. And, you know, what a day as we talk about this story and you think about the situation at the high school down in Texas. There are just a lot of broken hearts all around, and it's just so tough. But he had these questions, and I know Mayor Cranley said, look, you know, our mission is to have answers to each of those questions for you. So, you know, I would have to assume that we'll find out more insight relatively soon. But as far as an action plan, Jay, you certainly know the inner workings of City Hall better than I do. It doesn't sound like we're at that point yet.
I think what is surprising to me is a lot of people, originally this hearing was set for May the 2nd, and Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters got a subpoena because there were some items in the review that he had not seen, so he asked that it be put on hold until he had a chance to review them. So there was almost 2 weeks from when the report was originally to be presented to when it actually was presented, and a lot of people were looking to that report for answers to a lot of questions. And it seems to me Jason Williams hit it right, and I'll give him credit. He's a columnist for The Enquirer. He called it a 49-page pile of pass the buck. And actually a report that was meant to answer questions actually generated more questions. The Plush family, I believe, has 33 questions that they want answered. Council member Amy Murray said during the hearing she had a list of at least 30 questions that she wanted answered. So something that was supposed to clear up what went wrong, actually, I think the report actually created more questions in people's minds, which is I don't think what they had intended. And that's probably why now Council Member Smith, the majority, the unanimous city council has said maybe we need to do an independent review of this whole incident.
Todd, were there specific questions that Ron Plush was asking that you think really were key questions? I know there's a lot of questions, and every one of them is important, but were there ones that were particularly important as you listened that day?
Yeah, absolutely, Dan. And I'll piggyback on what Jay just was talking about. I'm looking at my notes from that day, transcribing some of the comments that Mr. Plush made. At one, you know, he started toward the beginning of his comments. He said, quote, "I was expecting that by hearing the police report today, many of my questions would be answered. This is not the case." So that sort of set the tone for the rest of what was to come. He then listed those questions one by one. And I think, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I think of all the city services and wherever you live, you know, the one thing that you hope works, and I know this is a really unique set of circumstances, but when you call 911, when you make a plea for help, that if a rescue team can get to you, whatever that looks like, that will happen. I will say, you know, in talking to Fraternal Order of Police President Dan Hills during the hearing earlier this week and afterwards to Chief Isaac, both expressed the sentiment that in their 30 years of law enforcement, this is such a unique set of circumstances, the way Kyle died, what happened. So, you know, it's important, I think, to keep that in mind. And both sort of indicated that if they do law enforcement for 30 more years, they may never encounter something this unusual. But I think to your question, Dan, the key issue, I think, that Ron Plush wanted answered, at least early in the list of questions, was about the GPS capability, the idea that his son was calling from a smartphone. Did those coordinates make it from the call takers and the dispatcher to the officers in the field? Clearly, that does not seem to have been the case. There seem to be two different computer systems. A lot of intrigue there about what should be done, what shouldn't be done. But, you know, in today's world, with the technology that we have, I think it's entirely fair to wonder, you know, why can't you be able to pinpoint that location? My colleague Brian Hamrick has done a lot of work on this, probably more so than I have. And Brian is, you know, early on, he took his phone and just put in these coordinates that he got from the emergency call center, some documentation there, and it pinged, whether it was Google Maps or whatever app he was using, and it pinged within a handful of feet of where that van was. You know, now all that hindsight, Monday morning quarterbacking, but, you know, something along those lines, you can see why Mr. Plush was asking so many questions about that kind of technology. Is it in place or should it be?
Well, it sounds like from what the police chief answered to that was, they don't have that technology right now, but they expect to get it within the next year. But, you know, same thing. I can be on a golf course and there's GPS that can tell me within 3 feet how far, no matter where I am, how deep I am in the woods, how far I am from the hole. It's unbelievable.
And the Enquirer go ahead, Todd.
No, I was going to say, yeah, I hope you talk about the Enquirer's terrific reporting today. Certainly credit to what they've looked at. But I'll say a couple other things just briefly. You know, we talked about the first dispatcher, I believe, tried to call the number back after Kyle. So for those who are, you know, may not have the sense of what had happened, and I remember covering this the day after the death had been reported, and it was so puzzling. I was like, what happened here? How could a young person be crushed by a van seat? I thought in my head maybe there was some kind of mechanized van seat that just a lever got pushed and it went down. You know, as we now know, that wasn't the case. This is just like a routine minivan that he just got pinned in a terrible way. And, of course, his hands were in his pockets. He's voice activating his phone to call 911. Does so twice over about a 20-minute period. But it's interesting. I think the first call taker, from what I understand, called the number back and it went to voicemail. And then I believe the Hamilton County deputy who had been on the scene at the school dealing with some traffic issues tried the number two. And if, you know, his aunt, Ron Plush's sister-in-law, made the point during that hearing earlier this week that it wasn't a generic voicemail. It wasn't just, hey, I'm not here, call me back. It said, hey, this is Kyle, I'm not here. You know, so the question then became, should maybe the officers have gone to the school and just sort of asked around, hey, I'm getting a weird call about a Kyle, and I got a voicemail, and do you have a Kyle? Now, who knows if that would have led anywhere, but that was part of the conversation during the hearing. But Jay, into the computer system, I think that's an important piece of reporting to point out.
And I think that was something else that a couple of council members on the police officers who responded, if they had a general idea that it was this parking lot next to a thrift store, how many vans were actually in the parking lot, and should they have done a better job actually getting out of the vehicles and checking the vans? Focusing on the vans in that parking lot.
I want to get to two questions. Council has committed to hiring an outside investigator, is my understanding.
There's a motion. It hasn't been formally approved yet, but it's all a matter of when it will be approved.
But it was unanimous in terms of the support.
The
right?
Motion had everyone's signature.
So the question becomes, how quickly can that be started? And yes, the police chief supported that, but how much will the police be open to this?
I don't think they're going to have a choice. If you have, you know as well as I do, it's hard to get nine members of city council to agree to anything. And if you have all nine of them saying, we want this to happen, I think it's going to happen. Now, there may be some haggling about who does it, how much it's going to cost. But if with that kind of support and with – had the police report answered a lot of these – if the police report itself had answered questions instead of generating more questions – there might be, maybe it won't go anywhere, but I'm almost certain that this is going to happen.
Todd, I'm almost out of time, but I want to ask this question. Has this entire incident, including the development and delivery of this report, has this undermined council and the mayor's confidence in the police chief?
You know, that's a question that I've asked of my colleagues. We've had this conversation. I mean, I know P.G. Sittenfeld from council talking to Chief Isaac during the hearing earlier, the public safety meeting, saying, I have every confidence in you, Chief Isaac, and so forth. But boy, it's just one of those situations where the more this onion gets peeled back a little bit, you just wonder about maybe there should have been protocols that have been thought about. Now, where the buck stops, I don't know. And I will say another quote real quickly for the listeners. Ron Plush made the comment saying you need to set politics and interoffice workings aside, talking to council. I think that would include the police department. He says, quote, I personally will not stand for it, and I will be vocal. I owe that to Kyle, the rest of my family, and the citizens of this community. So I think you have a man in Ron Plush who is kind of every man in a lot of ways, and he lost this horrible tragedy for his family and himself, and it just this can't, this kind of thing, you just hope it never happens again. Although, again, the circumstances are so unbelievably strange and in a certain way. And just briefly, Dan, Jay was, I think, going to mention that inquiry reporting. It sounded like the city passed on a system last year that would have enabled this kind of GPS sharing to the officers in the field. Now, would that have made a difference in this case? I don't know. But that's something that certainly we all need to explore more.
Okay, Jay, you have one quick question.
Just real quickly, and this is something that could have helped in this. There's a new app that Hamilton County launched. It's called Smart 911, and you can actually set up a profile where if you had a teenager with a cell phone, you could put in contact information, for parents, so that if that popped up on their screen and they couldn't have heard Kyle, perhaps they'd say, oh, here are other numbers that we could call to see what's going on. The city right now does not have that. I would assume that that's probably something that's going to be coming to the city, but Hamilton County does. So Hamilton County residents, if you rely on the county's 911 center, that's something that you could set up, and that way you know that if your child can't be heard, they know who to contact.
Really good information. Todd, thank you very much for joining us today. The long-running drama of FC Cincinnati took a major step this week. On Wednesday, the team and representatives of the West End Community Council negotiated for 9 hours to hammer out a community benefits agreement, which could be the last big substantive step the team needs to take its case and present it for admission to the Major League Soccer. To discuss what's the agreement, what's in it, and what's left to get done, I'm joined by WVXU Jay Hanselman, and WCPO.com reporter Amanda Seitz. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Amanda, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
So here we are, 9 hours. It seems to me, from what I can read, the big change from what we knew going into this negotiation, earlier drafts of the community benefits agreement, is that the West End Community Council is now a full party to the agreement, not a third party. Practically speaking, what does that mean?
Well, so it was kind of interesting when we first got this community benefits agreement. What was that, about a month ago?
April 16th, I think, was the date that I saw on it.
Yeah, so about a month ago, it was this big kind of dog and pony show the day that council was set to pass the public funding for the initial community benefits agreement for the soccer stadium. And basically, it was FC Cincinnati saying, we agree to this community benefits agreement that we've written, and we agree with ourselves on this. So, on
tough negotiations.
Correct. So not a 9-hour session for that one. But so basically, what we saw on Wednesday was the West End Community Council coming to the table and saying, like, here's what we really want, in hammering out a deal with both FC Cincinnati and the Port Authority, who will ultimately own the stadium.
Right, and then lease it to FC Cincinnati.
Correct.
So one of the things, the team has agreed to pay $100,000 annually for 30 years to West End organizations. That's mm-hmm. the way it's put. What organizations?
Youth soccer is the biggest beneficiary on that.
Right. And I think then they also, that's beyond that, but there's also another, up to another $100,000 they're going to pay for a housing study.
Yeah. And that was a new one. I heard just from people that were inside in the negotiations that the affordable housing piece was a really big sticking point, that there was just a lot of disagreement over whose ultimate responsibility it was to get affordable housing in the West End. I mean, obviously, FC Cincinnati, you know, they have said all along, we're not developers. We are not going to be building affordable housing in the West End. But the community really wanted a guarantee that there will be some type of affordable housing component. And I'm told that's where the Port Authority really kind of came in and helped usher those negotiations.
Well, one of the points on that is that the team says in this agreement, it will transfer options it holds on the West End land to the Redevelopment Authority to build, quote, affordable mixed income market rate housing. So it's transferring that over to the Port Authority, which actually isn't still called the Port Authority, but
correct.
Hamilton County
Even
Development.
The Port Authority forgets that it's not called that anymore.
<That's right>.
Sometimes.
can't figure out the names. But so that land piece was important.
Mm-hmm. And FC Cincinnati, those pieces are the pieces that FC Cincinnati bought options to earlier this year from the CMHA.
And I think, aren't they kind of more scattered lots? They're not like one big parcel of real estate next to each other, just kind of scattered.
Yes. So right. That, and FC Cincinnati has maintained that has been their intention all along, is to sell that to at least a housing developer. And this kind of puts a more guarantee that it will be affordable housing.
I thought one interesting thing was the comment that David Mann made right before they voted on this in the Budget and Finance Committee, that the document itself lists the West End Community Council, the port, and the team. But he also included the city as a partner, but they're not necessarily named in the agreement. But he had some pretty heavy lifts on some of the things that the city was going to have to be involved with. He mentioned the housing, gentrification, and some other issues. And like I said, even though they're not named in the agreement, it sounded like that, you know, that the city has got its work cut out for its too, to make this happen.
Is that a reference to his statement that some problems that remain that aren't in this agreement really fall to the city? Is that what you're really?
That's kind of the sense that I got.
Yeah.
But they're not, but the trick is they're not spelled out what the solutions are necessarily going to be yet.
Yeah.
And it was necessary too that the city be on board with this, because they said in their agreement with FC Cincinnati that they will not release the $37 million in public financing until a CBA was signed with the community.
And that's the other thing that I thought is interesting through this whole process is, from the beginning, we will not be rushed into making decisions. When this was originally, the public financing was approved for Oakley in late November, early December. It was pushed through. When the public financing was done again on April the 16th, the council had a special meeting to approve it. This negotiating session was supposed to last 5 hours. It lasted 9. They actually recessed a special Budget and Finance Committee meeting to consider it. They actually recessed the full council meeting that was going on at the same time while they waited to get this done on Wednesday. But they were not going to be rushed.
Well, at an earlier stage too, when they were negotiating with the West End, it was like, this is the date by which it has to get done. And if it doesn't, we're sort of cooked.
And that was the option, I think, on some of those properties that they had to exercise.
Yes. Yeah. But there's been a lot of deadlines too throughout this whole process.
Which I think has been interesting. And I think the school board would argue that they made a decision early on in their negotiations. They weren't going to be rushed, and they were going to insist on moving forward systematically. They ended up getting basically what they were demanding.
Yeah, and they were very clear they laid out a plan too, which I think was really helpful for everyone, because they said this, you know, here are the hearings that we're going to go through, here's everything we're going to do, and they checked off all of that list. Of course, now we're still waiting for that supposed MLS bid.
And I want to pick up on that, because I can't decide which analogy is better, the boy who cried wolf, or maybe this one is better. It somewhat seems like Charlie Brown and Linus with the football. that every time Cincinnati gets ready to kick the football, MLS picks up the ball and Cincinnati lands flat on its back, because we were told that, again, it was November, December. We might know something by the end of December. And then once they got the West End agreement in the middle of April, that was the last piece. We needed that piece done, and the announcement would be forthcoming. And then this week, the community benefits agreement, we just need that piece, and then that's a done deal.
Well, so, absolutely. I mean, it seems like there's a new hoop to jump through every week, and other cities that have recently been awarded bids, they haven't had to have this level of deals finalized. And I'm really interested to see how long. I mean, the MLS could theoretically draw this out for quite a while, because there are still
Who's drawing this out? Is it MLS or is it FC Cincinnati?
I mean, I think from my perspective, it seems like MLS at this point.
It seems like MLS.
FC Cincinnati can't award itself the bid. I'm sure they would have already if they could.
So you believe the MLS is squeezing to get everything locked up before they make the award?
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's a question as to why that is when they haven't done that with other cities.
And I think the next step that I've heard on other media that now we're waiting on the MLS commissioner, and I can't think of his name,
Don Gerber,
to visit Cincinnati, which should be sometime supposedly in the next couple of weeks.
There's another agreement that needs to be here. I mean, the convention visitors bureau facilities committee, for example, they actually control the hotel tax. They can have a say on whether that hotel tax gets used for this stadium. And so I'm really interested to see if that's another committee that this has to go through. And I don't think there are people that feel favorably about using this hotel tax for a stadium.
And actually, that's a little bit in limbo, because that was something else the council did. They formally passed the ordinance to allow them to use that tax to pay for the infrastructure, but it did not pass as an emergency ordinance. So it means it doesn't take effect for 30 days.
So
it's a lot to unpack there.
So one final question here. Not so much in terms of what still has to happen locally, but what's the sense of how we stack up with whatever cities are still supposedly in the running now that we've got this done?
I mean, I don't really think Detroit has ever really been a front runner in any way. I haven't seen a lot of conversation about them. Sacramento, the other finalist, is still looking for a billionaire to help fund this whole venture. I think one of the big holdups that I haven't heard a lot of chatter about recently, I think it could be the Columbus Crew. There's still a lot of unknowns if they will be moving to Austin. I'm sure the MLS is kind of waiting for that to be hammered out. And I don't know that they want two MLS soccer teams in one state that close to another.
And the other thing, if Don Gerber, did I say it right, comes to town, then it's going to be, is he here just to visit? Or is he also visit and he'll surprise us at the end and say, oh, you got the bid.
Okay, well.
And I'm sure we'll all be there asking that question.
All right. So I want to thank Jay Hanselman. We'll be right back to tackle the proposed new Children's Services Levy. Welcome back to Cincinnati Edition. One of the implications of the opioid epidemic became clear this week. Job and Family Services has had to remove thousands of children from addicted parents. That need endangers other critical services. The Tax Levy Review Committee has recommended a new Children's Services property tax levy that would raise $37 million over 3 years. That is on top of the existing Children's Services levy. To review what's happening here, WCPO reporter Amanda Seitz is staying right where she was just before our little break, and she's joined by Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Scott Wortman. Scott, welcome. Amanda,
thank you for having
thanks
me.
For staying.
Yeah, of course.
So how serious is the increase, Scott, in the number of children that Job and Family Services has had to take responsibility for?
Child welfare workers are overwhelmed. They've had they deal with about 20,000 kids a year in Hamilton County, which is 6,000 kids more than they were dealing with about 5 years ago. And a lot of them, about half of the families that they deal with, the families that go through child welfare services statewide, are addicted to some form of opiates, or have a parent, I'm sorry, that's addicted
right.
to
Not
some
form.
Not the
children,
yes.
It's the parents.
Yes. And the number has increased by about 10% locally for JFS on the families that they're dealing with, that are dealing with opioid addiction of some sort.
So, Amanda or Scott, whichever one knows this best, if when a child comes into the system, what's involved? Who's impacted? What kind of costs are involved? What are we dealing with here?
Well, and I mean, I've had numerous conversations with Children's Services about this over the years. It varies so widely. I mean, it could be, and when we're talking about 20,000 kids in Children's Services, that's any child that Children's Services made contact with. So that doesn't necessarily mean kids that are being taken out of the home. It could mean they, you know, have to do welfare checks or maybe follow up with the parents. But it could range all the way to a child that is taken out of the home. There are even children that are in JFS custody that are taken out of state to go to facilities. So the type, and that's the most expensive of cases, of course. I mean, that can cost tens of thousands of dollars just for one child every year. But there's just such a wide range of the type of cases that we're talking about here.
One of the more stark examples that the head of St. Joseph Orphanage gave when they were making the pitch on, you know, how dire the need is, one of the doctors there recently, a family brought their kids in to the orphanage, and the doctor was doing a routine physical. And the doctor found 10 baggies of cocaine on the child because the parent was hoping to hide them and that no one would find them. And that's pretty much the head of the orphanage said, this is what we're dealing with.
Oh, my
God. I do think it's important to note that this levy, this potential levy ask, though, is not just the result of the heroin
sure.
epidemic or that increase. Children's Services has faced drastic staffing cuts over years, along with the rest of the county, because of loss in state funding, because of loss in sales tax, bringing that in. So they've had, I can't remember the last number that I pulled, but they've had lots of support staff cut.
Well, at one point during the recession, literally 50%.
Yes.
And they sold a piece of property, the offices up in Mount Auburn. They had to get rid of that because they had to cut back so much. And that was because of state cuts.
Yes.
And I believe this level of state funding is the same as it's been since 2000 while they're dealing with all these thousands of more children.
Yes. And not to mention that the levy has not been increased in 20 years. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of factors stressing this system. Now, I know Children's Services has talked with me before about they have not really made deep cuts to the frontline workers, but they've had to make cuts to kind of the support staff that helps these frontline workers cope. And that's caused high stress, high turnover among a lot of these social workers that are already dealing with an extremely stressful and high demand job.
And that means that when there's high stress, a lot of turnover, that means you're constantly mm-hmm. hiring, constantly training. That's expensive.
Yeah, there's a lot of echoes of the 911 center in Cincinnati here, some of the same problems. In 2016, 43% of the Children's Services staff had turned over. I mean, those are huge numbers. And the caseloads, too, that these staffers are dealing with are higher than the national, basically the national recommendation for the caseloads as well.
And they hasten to point out, too, that the more caseworkers that a child has, the harder it is to find a permanent resolution for mm-hmm. them, for whatever their situation is.
Yeah, that was a really interesting tidbit, I thought.
Well, the trauma that the child goes through with mm-hmm. they're already pulled away from their parents, if there's lack of stability. And this has all sorts of implications outside of just JFS too. The courts are involved. Juvenile court is involved. There's a lot of magistrates who have hearings every child has to. There's CASAs that need to be appointed to supervise and to oversee to make sure that child is treated right. There are all kinds of implications for this situation in this system. Mm-hmm. If JFS did not get the additional funding that's proposed in this property tax increase and took the approach, we're going to cut programs. What kind of programs are we talking about that would have to be cut?
Well, most, and the way I understand it, most of the services of JFS are mandated. Mm-hmm. A lot of the cuts, I mean, there are some extra programs that could be cut, but a lot of the cuts would have to come elsewhere in the county, the way I understand it.
Yeah, and I don't know that we necessarily heard to what those cuts would look like. I think we more heard that JFS does have a reserve fund. I believe it's of over $100 million is
It is now, but they're going to that's going to run out in a little over 2 years.
Yes, and they've already begun dipping into that this year. And I believe there's some state law or some rule that says that they have to have it at a certain number, those reserves, just to be healthy as far as their money.
My guess is you would see cuts elsewhere in the county, maybe at the jail. That would even be further cut. Other county services would probably get cut and would have to subsidize JFS.
Which has all sorts of other implications.
Yes.
So what's your sense of the way that the Tax Levy Review Commission has delivered its report? How do you think it's going to be, or how has it been received by the commissioners?
Well, this is of all the needs, because it involves vulnerable children, they place this as the top priority. The problem with it is they're already considering a sales tax. The county is considering a sales tax increase to put on the November ballot just to fund the basic needs and shore up a $28 million deficit they're anticipating. So this is one of many needs.
And that would be about, what, a half a cent sales tax?
Quarter cent.
Quarter cent sales tax. Yes.
And this is on top of the library just raised their tax rate, doubled their tax rate.
Which the commissioners didn't have any.
No.
They don't get to approve that.
They did not want that.
The voters, though, resoundingly, that won by 30%.
That's
so,
right.
And I don't anticipate, I mean, I don't know, but I wouldn't anticipate child services would have necessarily a problem getting the levy. But then for the other needs of the county, could be a tough sale for the sales tax.
We already saw some concern, I think, from Commissioner Chris Monzel, who's the only Republican left on the board. He was kind of questioning, you know, other counties get more money and don't meet some of the standards that Hamilton County is able to meet with less money. So he brought that
standards up. Standards in terms of how the children are cared for?
Basically, like if they're back in, there's like 12 standards and stuff like if they're back in county care within 12 months, have they found permanent placement, standards like that. And Hamilton County is meeting a lot of those. So he brought up that point that, you know, these other counties get more money, but we're meeting, in some cases, more.
So is his argument we ought to be getting more money, or is his argument we should allow some of these standards to slip?
He was questioning whether more money would help the county solve some of those issues, because it hasn't in other counties, basically, was his point. Commissioner Denise Strehouse, however, is a big proponent of this levy. She says it's her number one priority. And Commissioner Todd Portune, we haven't heard him really weigh in exactly, but in 2016, when the two Republican commissioners voted not to do an increase, he vocalized concerns about that at the time. I think, too, with the library levy, because that was a property tax, there's a lot of good feelings about how voters are feeling about property taxes with the library levy passing, with Preschool Promise passing. Sales tax is another question.
Denise Strehouse said that they will probably look to – there are two other levies up next year, and she indicated that she would be pushing to keep those flat so you could save up space and a will – to raise taxes with the JFS and possibly the sales tax.
For a long period of time, the Tax Levy Review Commission, their commitment was no tax increase. If they were going to raise it for a particular levy, they were going to reduce some other levy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was held, I think, for 12 years.
And that was,
is that right?
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that's because you had a Republican-controlled commission.
Gee, I know.
That appoint. I mean, Denise Driehaus and Todd Portune, both Democrats, came in and they really shook up that committee, and that was very intentional. So it'll be very. I think too. There's a kind of a question: do Hamilton County voters, they are ready to pay for some of those fun things like our stadiums at the riverfront, the library, the zoo? Are they willing to pay for those basic services when it comes to a tax increase?
And when do the commissioners have to make a decision about whether this goes on the November ballot?
August 8th.
So we've got sort of several months of either discussion, education, or debate coming up to find out what this means. Scott, I probably should have asked you this early on. 37 million is the big number. But what does this mean for every $100,000 worth of value on property? How much would this actually be?
It would be an additional $73 per $100,000.
And that's on top of
the $54, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so then, it'd more than double. But as Amanda pointed out, this would be the first tax increase in 2 decades.
And the goal would be that this would be a 3-year levy so that those two then could be combined at the end of 3 years when the other one has to be renewed so that we just have this one levy we can consider every 5 years.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yep.
So, well, this is obviously something we're going to continue to talk about. And I really want to thank Amanda Seitz and Scott Wortman for being here today to catch us up on this. The federal government suspects that a Findlay Market vendor was involved in bilking the government for $45 million since 2010. For a look into this situation, I'm joined by Cincinnati Enquirer reporter James Bilger, who has followed the story. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. James, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Just real quick, it was actually $3.4 million, just to make sure that
you know. $3.4 million, what did I say?
$45 million.
So. Oh, well, okay.
Yeah, a million here, a million there. That's all. Okay. It's still a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. So the raid was actually carried out by the Secret Service.
Yes.
That may surprise people.
Well, it was actually the Secret Service and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which does have its own law enforcement agency. Yes. So the Secret Service actually investigates currency and benefit fraud, as well as protecting the president and among other things. So that's why they were involved. And obviously, the program is run. It's all about food stamps and the SNAP program, which is actually run by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So that's why they were involved. So actually, the FBI didn't have anything to do with this, which is really unusual. They did get local assistance from Cincinnati Police and the Office of the Ohio Bureau of Investigation, but it was a federal operation. So they did raid them. There were search warrants and seizure warrants. They took 4 or 5 vehicles. They took hundreds of thousands of dollars out of their bank accounts. And this all stems from alleged fraud involving food stamps out of Bush's Country Corner, which has been there for almost 20 years, yes. Or more, 21 years, actually.
And I want to be clear, Bush's Country Corner is the business involved here.
Yes.
It's not Findlay Market whole. It is one business.
It's one store. It's one store out of hundreds at Findlay Market, yes. And it's one of about 50-plus stores that accepts food stamps at Findlay Market. And, you know, I talked to the Findlay Market officials and they said they can't ever remember anything like this happening there. Yeah. It was when it first happened, it made the news. But then a sharp-eyed editor who I work with said, you know, we ought to take another look at this. This is some big money here and this is very interesting. And of course, Findlay Market being iconic as it is, we decided to go back and we dove into the federal documents and saw just how it worked or how they said it worked. And then it got more interesting yesterday when the lawyer for the co-owners, called me up and said, hey, you got to know the other side of the story.
Well, let's do this one at a time. We'll get to the new thing
that
came up yesterday. But how did it work?
Okay. So they actually started to, they were tipped somehow to the fact that Bush's was conducting way more food stamp transactions for much higher amounts than anybody around them.
Inside the market.
Inside and outside the market that did the same kind of thing. So, you know, they did like $5 or $6 million in food stamp transactions, more than $5 million in food stamp transactions in 8 years alone. So that's a lot of money. So they, over the last 12 to 14 months, sent undercover agents and confidential informants to do these buys. So they would come up with their, what they're called EBT cards, which have all their benefits on them. They're basically ATM cards with their food stamps on them. They would say, you know, talk to the manager there, say, hey, I got this. And the guy would say, oh, okay. And they'd swipe the card for upwards of $1,000, $1,500.
So big purchases.
Yes. Hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. And they would then get $500, $600, $700, $800 back in cash and what was called a minimal amount of meat product. So maybe a chicken or some, you know, wings or something.
Well, they did come to the store. They needed something.
Yeah, they could walk away with a bag. Some of them did not walk away with any product. So,
it was
according to the
just,
affidavit. Yeah. So, but then the rest, the feds alleged that the rest then went floated into the account of the owners. Because, I mean, you know, so you're talking, okay, so on the $1,000 one, it was like $1,000, $1,100. The people got $800 back in cash, and then the Bushes kept $300, $400. So that was what they said happened. And it's a big deal. I mean, there's there are, according to the feds, $1 billion a year is trafficked in fake or fraudulent EBT charges. Okay. So, I mean, it's a major issue nationally. So they're cracking down on it. It's a $61 billion program. So, you know, so it's not an insignificant amount of money. So then, you know, we run the story. And then yesterday, the defense lawyer who the co-owners hired called me up and said, well, you're going to know the other side of this. And basically, his assertion is that the co-owners, Amanda and Michael Bush, who started the stand, took over the stand in 1997, knew nothing of this. And it was Michael's brother, Randall, who was doing this under the table, unbeknownst to them.
Who worked there?
He was the manager. Mm-hmm. He managed the place while the Bushes handled a lot of the back end stuff, the accounting, and the, you know, they actually farmed the chickens and you know, because they're well known for their poultry, the turkeys and chickens and things like that. So so that's the latest twist. And they also say this also stems from a dispute with somebody else in the market who, you know, ratted him out to the feds. So it just it's a bit of a soap opera. But it is also, you know, concerning. And, you know, the Findlay market officials are watching this very intently to see if any criminal charges are, because they can kick them out. If they're charged, there's no charges yet. There's not gone in front of a grand jury. There's no indictments. So, you know, they're watching and waiting and seeing what happens.
So what did they do? They went to a federal judge to get the the documents they needed.
Yes.
To go in, yes. Seize, yes, money, cars.
But they also did – they were looking for documents. They were looking for evidence of this actually happening. Yes, they went to a magistrate judge. And they didn't seal it, which was interesting. So they must have known that, you know, they did a very public raid. They shut down half of Findlay Market to do this last Thursday. And so, you know, like I said, it hit the news and whatever. But, you know, and it's really interesting, too, to see the reaction. You know, we posted it on Facebook, and it's been one of the more popular stories of the week. So it touched a lot of people because, I mean, it's just where it is, how much money it was. And so it was –
So what would you expect to have happen at this point?
I think – well, given the – it depends on the – you know, given the track record of the feds and the agencies involved, I would say, you know, within months, we will have some kind of resolution in court, whether it's – indictments actually handed out against everybody, plea deals, whatever. Although that being said, I liken this to the Evans Landscaping situation where, you know, he's been criminally charged and the company's been criminally charged with minority hiring fraud and mail fraud by the FBI. Well, they raided him very publicly and it took almost a year to actually file charges. So I would say within a period of 3 to 6 months, we should know something, but it could stretch out longer. And so that's, it could be, again, it could be it actually turns into charges. It could be plea deals. It could be whatever.
So at this moment, the business is still in operation,
yes,
right?
They're not accepting any credit cards or EBT anymore. That was taken away. They're only accepting cash. They have a sign up saying cash only at the store, but they are open.
Okay. And how do you think this is impacting other businesses at Findlay Market?
I don't know. I mean, the Findlay folks are trying their hardest to try to say, to distance themselves and say, hey, we're not them. We're business as usual and whatever. I don't necessarily think that, you know, at least the coverage has been very specific that this was one stand and not the whole market. So I really can't gauge that. I haven't gone to the market in a couple of days to see. You know, I know it was slow on Wednesday, but it was Wednesday. So, you know, this will be the first weekend since really everything's been out there to see, and we'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, just so everybody's clear, the market itself, the market house, is owned by the city.
Yes.
And the stalls are leased.
Yes.
And passed down generation to generation in many cases.
Well, the guy that owns Bush's started by selling hot dogs at another stand. And then, you know, went off and did something else. And then this other guy retired where the Bush's store is now, and he basically took it over. So that's how that all happens. You're right. It is passed down or you know, re-up the lease or whatever. And a lot of those places have been there for 20, 30, 40 years.
Oh, yeah. Those are highly competitive and desired
exactly
spots.
But, I mean, you know, the lawyer for the Bush's was saying that there was – physical intimidation and threats and stuff by other vendors against them and competitors. So, you know, there might be a little seamy underside to what goes on there after dark or between the competitors. I'm sure it gets competitive out there because I know I walk down, I'm looking for a good steak, right? And you're looking at the prices and the quality and I'm sure, you know, they're yelling.
Comparing.
Exactly. So I'm sure that goes on back and forth.
Well, every one of those stands, every one of those small businesses has their own following. And people are very committed to the quality of the meat, the
absolutely
quality of what's going on there. And this, of course, also raises the larger question of SNAP and
yes,
EBT cards and all of that, which is, as you said, very large. And lots of people have raised questions about how this program has grown over the years.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Thanks you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Fun or interesting story you've uncovered here. And I'd like to thank all the reporters who joined us today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website at WVXU.org. I'm Dan Hurley.